Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. The first order of business today is that I am going to draw from a hat the name of a District 4 Court of Appeals judge to fill a vacancy on the Government Accountability Board Candidate Committee. The vacancy was created by the retirement of Judge Charles Geithner. And the candidate committee consists of one Court of Appeals judge from each of the four Court of Appeals districts, chosen by lot by the Chief Justice in the presence of the other justices. Now, this is governed by Section 15.60, paren to paren. And that committee then selects people for the Government Accountability Board. So I will draw that in the presence of the justices and in your presence.
Mix them up, Chief.
And I drew two. This really should not be hard. It should not create a problem. Margaret Vergeron, Judge Vergeron. So if you would advise Kevin Kennedy and
Mr. Kennedy.
He's here.
Okay. Did I do it okay?
Fine.
That's what you're supposed to say. And then advise Margaret Vergeron, and if the standard practice is to draft an order. Sign it, okay? Maybe a judicial function, maybe not, but I don't have to rule on that at the moment. But it illustrates various things the court does, and we have today students with us from the Southwest Wisconsin Technical College. Would they stand, please? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we have people from the Department of Justice, Wisconsin Department of Justice. Would they stand, please? And thank you for coming. I assume your interns as well as members of the department are here with you. And thank you for coming. You may be seated. Neither of these groups is part of our Court with Class program, which is generally invites high school and some middle school students to come to oral argument. And what we will do, though, is offer you all of the comforts and perks of that program. So first, does everyone have material relating to this case so that they know the facts and the legal issue? If you don't, would you raise your hand and we'll give you a summary of the case? Okay, everybody's got a summary. That's fine. Number two, will you be coming back or staying for the whole session? Southwest Technical College has a number of students at each session. The reason I ask, because if you're available at about 12:15, a justice would be willing to come and speak with you about the procedures of the court. Not the substantive issues in the case, but the procedures of the court. So are you coming back or not? Raise your hands if you're coming back.
Yes, we are.
Good. All right. And then there will be a justice, and I'll tell you who in a minute. That's the surprise here. And I didn't pick it out of a hat. Let me introduce the justices to you. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. And to his left is Justice Patience Robinsack. And Justice Robinsack will meet with you at 12:15 or thereabouts to discuss the procedural aspects of our taking cases and how we ultimately reach decisions. And on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. We're now going to excuse Justice Crooks because he will not be participating in this case. I will call the first case today, which is 08-AP-3144, CR, State v. Gerard W. Carter. Arguing for the state is Michael Sanders, Assistant Attorney General. You may proceed.
May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General Michael Sanders, representing the state of Wisconsin in this case. This case concerns Wisconsin's statutes governing the counting of prior out-of-state offenses to enhance the sentence for a subsequent OWI-related offense. In particular, it concerns WISSTAT 343-307 sub 1 and 340-019-R. The Court of Appeals has interpreted these statutes in some cases in two ways, which do not really mesh. This has led to inconsistent results. The state asks that this court clarify by determining the proper method of determining whether out-of-state offenses count for sentence enhancement purposes under Wisconsin law. In this case, the state asks that this court conclude that the circuit court correctly determined that Carter's Illinois zero tolerance or absolute sobriety violations count for sentence enhancement purposes in Wisconsin. This court should therefore reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals. The two approaches that the Court of Appeals have taken started in State v. List. In List, what was at issue was an Illinois offense. It was an OWI, but it wasn't treated with a conviction as you would normally think of under our as you would normally think of it. The defendant there pled and was put on court supervision, which is essentially a deferred prosecution program. In List, the court determined that offense would still count under our law, even though it's not what you would think of as a standard judicial conviction. The court reached that result by looking first to 340-019-R, which defines conviction for the purposes of our counting statute, 343-307 sub 1. The court looked at that and determined whether the conduct in the other state was covered under 343-307 sub 1 as defined in 340-019-R. It determined that it was, and so it counts as a conviction, even though it wasn't what we would consider full judicial conviction. The court in that case rejected the idea that Wisconsin courts should look to the other state's laws to determine whether it was a conviction under their law. What the court said is instead we look to Wisconsin law to determine whether we're going to count the offense from the other state.
Do you agree with that position?
Yes.
So
I think that's the yes.
Regardless of whether the other state treats it as a conviction, the question is whether it would be a conviction under Wisconsin law.
It's not whether we would necessarily count what happened in that state as a conviction. It's whether under what we term a conviction under 340-019-R, it was a violation of their law regarding OWI.
I don't understand that.
I may not have said that exactly the way I meant
Well, you can, one way of doing it is to say, well, Illinois treats this, under Illinois law, this would be a conviction. Therefore, Wisconsin is going to treat it as a conviction. Or you say, we see what happened under Illinois law. Then we say, well, this is what happened. And under 9R, that would or would not be a conviction under Wisconsin law. Now, I hear you saying a third way.
It would. I agree with what you said as way number two, except it's not whether it would constitute a violation of Wisconsin's OWI law.
No, I didn't say that.
Okay,
I said, would the proceeding constitute a conviction of anything under Wisconsin law?
Sure.
Just a conviction?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So you favor the latter?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that if you read all of the words of the statutes, and if you apply 340.019R, which I think you have to do under our law, then there's really no other answer, that's where it leads.
Well, I'm not so sure it's so plain. Convictions under the law of another jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that would sound like, was it a conviction under Illinois that prohibits a person from refusing blah, blah, blah? That's D.
Well, that is one way that it could be read, but both in the Court of Appeals in List and the Court of Appeals in Machen said that isn't how you read it.
I understand that, but we're really reviewing this whole area of the law because
sure.
you say there's conflict, right?
Oh, yeah.
So I'm saying, what's the state's position on this, and you say you're going to favor the Court of Appeals position.
In List,
okay.
Not in Machen or Carter.
Well, it's arguable that List refers to one kind of fact situation and the other cases refer to another fact situation and that they don't really disagree ultimately about what conviction means. Anyway, that's an argument.
I agree with that.
I would assume you could look at it,
but I don't.
Well, isn't the conflict between List and Machen is that in List the court said you must apply the definition under 340.012 to determine whether you count this or not, and Machen says that doesn't apply. You don't use 340.01 paren 9R in your determination.
Yes.
Right. So I mean, you either use it or you don't, but we got
yes.
Court of Appeals decisions saying yes you do and no you don't.
I think that's the main source of conflict with the two different lines of cases, and that there's really only one way which makes sense, and that's the way List did it.
Mr. Sanders, the record here, my reading of the record indicates that Mr. Carter had a prior conviction for operating a motor vehicle under the influence of an intoxicant in the state of Illinois.
Yes.
And he did not contest that as being counted. There were two, I believe the record indicates there were two violations of the zero tolerance law in
yes.
Illinois. Did Mr. Carter have the opportunity to seek either judicial or administrative review of those zero tolerance violations?
Oh yes.
What is that process?
Under the Illinois law, after the Secretary of State has determined that after these, there is a hearing, the Secretary, I take it back.
Probably the law enforcement report goes to the Secretary
yes.
of State. The Secretary makes it, or his or her designee makes a determination. And
yes.
And then Mr. Carter probably received notice of that and had a
yes.
certain time period in order to request some kind of administrative hearing. What I'm asking you to do, first of all, was the burden on Carter to request the administrative hearing?
Yes, it says that under...
Then, Mr. Sanders, what I'm asking is, what is the hearing? Please describe that hearing.
Under the law there, it says a driver may contest this suspension and disqualification by requesting an administrative hearing with the Secretary of State. The scope of the hearing is only on the issues of whether the officer had probable cause to believe that the person was driving or in actual control of the motor vehicle, whether the person was issued a uniform traffic ticket for any violation of their state code, whether the officer had probable cause to believe that the driver had consumed any amount of an alcoholic beverages based upon the driver's physical actions or other firsthand knowledge of the officer, whether the person, after being advised by the officer that the privilege to operate a motor vehicle would be suspended if the person refused to submit, and then did refuse to submit to chemical testing,
Are those issues the same or different than the issues that would be present in front of a similarly situated circuit court here in Wisconsin presiding over a refusal hearing?
I think they're essentially the same thing.
Are there any differences at all?
Not that I can think of. I would add that at the end of the hearing, the Secretary of State can rescind, continue, or modify the suspension. And then that action is subject to judicial review in the Circuit Court for Sangamon County or Cook County under the Administrative Review Law. So there are a lot of options for review if the defendant wishes to.
And Mr. Carter did not elect to seek that administrative review in either of his prior violations?
Not to the best of my knowledge.
Were they all refusal?
It's unclear from the record.
Right.
I think the length of these suspensions would strongly indicate that they were for refusals and not for taking a chemical test which disclosed a result above zero. It's not completely clear.
Isn't there a special subsection for refusal? Under E?
Oh, yes, under our law.
Yeah. So if it was a refusal, then it would come under E and we wouldn't be fighting about convictions. Under D.
Yes. If it were a refusal,
right.
I would argue that it would fall under E, and it also might fall under D, but it clearly would fall under E.
Right. So we don't really know whether it's a refusal or not. You're really arguing this case on the basis that whether it's a refusal or it's not a refusal, it falls under D as a conviction.
Yes.
Okay.
The trial court, when it looked at the driving record, just said he didn't say it's not clear, but I think the court thought it wasn't clear and said, I don't have to determine whether it's a refusal or whether he took the test. Either way, it falls under sub D or sub E.
Mr. Sanders, it's either a refusal or a violation of zero tolerance, right?
Yes.
So in other words, it's either a refusal or operating a motor vehicle with a prohibited alcohol content in the state of Illinois.
Yes.
Why does it matter in the analysis which of the two it is? Is it E or D?
If it's E, then I think there's really no argument. The defendant hasn't claimed that if this were an absolute sobriety refusal, that would not fall under sub E. And the trial court didn't find that. The Court of Appeals didn't find that. I don't think that there's any argument. So if it was clearly that, then I don't think we're here.
And you are not advancing that here, given the state of the record, are you?
I would argue that it probably was, but I can't say that there is enough in the record to say for certain that it was a refusal.
Let me use the language of the Court of Appeals opinion, and let me ask whether you think the state has met its burden of proof in showing that the zero-tolerance suspension was a result of the refusal to submit. The Court of Appeals said the state bears the burden. I'm looking at the Court of Appeals Appendix 107, 108. If I recall, they even said, hey, the length of suspension doesn't line up with what would be a Illinois refusal penalty, and you haven't met the burden. So I just want to make sure you're just going, which one are you, as one of my colleagues says, which horse are you riding?
And what difference does it make?
I think both are fine questions. We are riding the sub D horse, and I don't think it makes any difference.
Well, it would
make a difference if this clearly were a refusal. Then there would have been no question whatsoever. This falls under sub E, and we're not here.
The only question we're to decide today really is, were these convictions under D?
D.
That's the question.
Yes.
All right.
Your opinion asks us for just hold it a conviction. I'm looking at your brief. Do you ask for a remand to find out if it's under E, if should you lose?
I didn't know if that was appropriate on the
I
state of
either.
The record.
I don't either. I'm just asking you.
I did not ask for that. I don't know if that was appropriate on the state of the record because the trial court looked at what the state gave it, and it didn't make a finding either way, and I don't know that it erred in not making a finding.
And that'll be two kicks at the cat. You had your chance to make the proof. You didn't make it, or you did, and that's the end of it.
That's true. And one other thing is the state would like the court to determine how this works.
Right.
So if it were sent back without a determination of which of the two different roads the court should take, then we're going to be back here again.
Right.
So
you just
ideally,
want a definition of convictions.
Yeah. Just how courts are to count these. I think it's pretty clear that courts don't always do it the same way and that a trial court doesn't necessarily know which way to go.
Counsel, in light of Justice Gableman's questions and your answers earlier, it was interesting, you know, the hearing procedure in Illinois, but where in our statute does it make any difference at all as to whether someone has the right to a hearing or not, or what that hearing process or procedure is? It seems to me the language of the statute is if you have these kinds of convictions, that's it. You could default, and it would still count as a conviction. And you can in Wisconsin as well, true?
Yes.
All right. How do refusals work in Wisconsin? When there's a revocation under 343, 305 sub 10 for refusal, that counts as a conviction, right?
It does.
Right. So, you know, you don't have to have a hearing in a refusal even in the state of Wisconsin.
I would add that it works that way under 343, 05 sub 10 unless it's a refusal relating to an absolute sobriety violation. And then it doesn't count for enhancement purposes for a later OWI type of offense.
What about someone failing to get an assessment? How does that work?
I'm not certain.
Okay, fair enough.
Just because we have an audience with some younger students, you answered if it's a refusal for absolute sobriety, then it doesn't count as a conviction.
Yes.
And then, and what do you mean by conviction, a refusal for absolute sobriety?
If the person who is stopped by the officer is underage and the officer requests a test because he thinks the person has had some alcohol, if the person refuses the test, then there is a revocation under 343-305. But under 10EM, the statute specifically says we are not going to count that as an offense under 343-307. What the statute doesn't say is that we wouldn't count the same thing if it occurred out of state. The court could have said, or the legislature could have said that, could have said, but we also aren't going to count them if they're out of state. It hasn't done so.
What sense does it make to not count a violation of absolute sobriety if someone is under 21, has a drop of alcohol and is drinking? That's a violation of absolute sobriety. But if they do it in Beloit, it doesn't count. And if they drive and go a few miles south in South Beloit, it does count. Does that make any sense to you?
I think that they have made a choice to say that I don't know what exactly the policy reason is that Wisconsin has adopted in order to say that ours don't count later. But I think that in dealing with out-of-state laws, there are lots of different ways that the other states can address OWIs and PACs. For instance, A state could have a law that said all that they that you can't drink and drive, so that anyone, not based on age, but anyone who drives with a drop of alcohol has committed an absolute sobriety violation. And we would count those, because it doesn't matter if the other law isn't exactly like ours. We would still count it if that's what they consider a PAC violation.
Do you know what the rationale is for the legislative determination that if you commit your under 21 and you drink a drop and then refuse, I'll use the refusal or convicted in another way, that it doesn't count. What's the legislative reasoning, do you know, for that? And if that's question number one, and if it is to be assumed that it has something to do with youth, you know, why wouldn't that reasoning apply if they were South Beloit?
I can't think of any other reason that the Wisconsin law dealing with our own absolute sobrieties would not count them, except for what you brought up, youth. That I don't think that there's any other – I can't think of any other reason why they would do that. I think the reason not to do it in other states is just that we don't know how they're going to handle their laws, what ages they're going to have, if it's any age, if it's a certain age – if they change the age at which you can drink. I mean, there are just lots of different ways we could do it, and they just haven't chosen I guess my best answer would be that they haven't chosen to do that, which I think is clear when you look at the refusal statute, that under sub E, we clearly would count an absolute sobriety refusal in any other state, even though we clearly wouldn't count them here. So they have chosen to say, we're going to count theirs and we're not going to count ours. So if it's a question of 0.00 to 0.08, we don't count ours, and they've made the same choice that we don't count ours and we do count theirs. I don't know why they made the choice, but that's the choice that the words of the statute seems to indicate that they made.
It gets more complicated, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
And I think what I hear you saying, Mr. Sanders, is it may be a similar rationale that each of the several states may have for setting different prohibited alcohol concentrations.
Sure. And I think any state could set them at any point, and if they all made them at 0.00, we would still count them, as in the White case back in 1987, where under the old Wisconsin law, we wouldn't count a conviction from a state if their law wasn't in conformity with our law. In that case, we had a 0.10 standard. Minnesota had a 0.08. A guy who got a 0.08 in that state came here, got a drunk driving, and we didn't count it. And the court said, well, we don't count it because under our statute, it has to be in conformity. So they changed the statute. And in the White case, which came out later, they made clear that isn't the law. List relies on White, and a case from this past term, Puchaz, says the same thing, that we don't look to the other state law, we look to our law, and under our law, it counts as a conviction.
Counsel, you are asking us to say that 9R, 340.019R, the definition of convicted or conviction, mm-hmm. applies here, right?
Yes.
It says, quote, conviction or conviction convicted means an unvacated adjudication of guilt or a determination that a person has violated or failed to comply with the law in a court of original jurisdiction or an authorized administrative tribunal. Okay? Mm-hmm. So under what does this Illinois decision of suspending him fall? It's we agree, I think, it's not vacated, so that's okay, mm-hmm. right? Is it an adjudication of guilt, or is it a determination that a person has violated and failed to comply with the law in a court of original jurisdiction. It's not a court of original jurisdiction. So it has to be, I think. Do you think it's an adjudication of guilt? That's the first line.
I think it's a determination that a person has violated or failed to comply with the law.
By an authorized administrative tribunal.
In an authorized administrative tribunal.
Okay. So what's the administrative tribunal here?
The process of the Secretary of State, the hearing that the person has the right to, and the judicial review that can come later.
Does he have a right to a hearing before the Secretary of State? Or just to ask for an appeal?
I'm trying to remember.
We can look that up. But different states and different procedures are going to result in different answers here.
I expect that's true.
Okay. So,
and I think that's kind of the point, though, that they tried to make this extremely broad because different states might handle them in ways that aren't exactly like other states. And the point is to make it so that you don't have to every time look at case law from each state and look at,
But the state does have to show a determination by an authorized administrative tribunal.
Okay. Yes.
And here, Secretary of State was enough because they didn't appeal.
I don't know if he appealed. I don't think it's clear from what – I don't think it's clear.
Well, but you needed – and maybe does the words unvacated refer only to adjudication? Or does it refer to determination?
I'm sorry, I changed that.
It says conviction or convicted means an unvacated adjudication of guilt or a determination, blah, blah, blah. So unvacated precedes adjudication. Does it also mean a determination? In other words, had he appealed and the Secretary of State was overturned, would that be okay here? Would the state still have a right to charge it as one?
No.
Pardon me?
I don't think so, because then on his record, I don't think it would show up as a zero tolerance suspension.
So it means unvacated determination.
I would just think it's kind of assumed. That's what it means. I don't know from the way that the statute's written where the comma is. I'm not sure if that would necessarily imply
after guilt
more statutory construction. I'm not exactly sure if that would be it. But
by on the comma.
So I'm not certain, but I think it would just be kind of assumed that if it were a vacated determination, then the state wouldn't be counting it because it wouldn't show up on his record, and it would be pretty clear that it wouldn't make sense to count it.
Thank you, Mr. Sanders. You have 5 minutes
in
rebuttal. Attorney, is it Kuhari? Thank you, representing Gerard Carter.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and justices of the court. I am Attorney Craig Kuhari. I'm representing the defendant appellant in this case, Gerard Carter. And I think we are getting into the realm of Alice in the Looking Glass here when we're starting to talk about administrative procedures and whether or not it's an adjudication of guilt. Because I think we have to look at the statutes as a whole, as a unified whole, in their proper context in order to determine what a specified range of alcohol or above or in excess of the legal limits is really referring to. And I think that's the problem that we're having here, interpreting whether or not some other states' absolute sobriety violations are going to count as priors here. Because the way I interpret that entire statutory subsection, and when I'm referring to that subsection, I'm referring to 343.307, I believe that whole section, when read in its entirety, is referring to impaired driving offenses or offenses that are considered under the influence in our state. The statute basically begins by delineating convictions in Wisconsin that will count. And it's a pretty broad list. And What it does is it refers to 346.63 sub 1. So we start off by looking at the offenses that are going to count here first, and we list them. Well, sub 1 actually contains a number of subcomponents that aren't even listed there. But if you go back and you read 346.63 sub 1, you're going to see all of the same language that is summarized for states or courts of other jurisdiction under sub D. So I think there is a flow to the statute, and we have to look at that statute in context and as it relates to the other statutes that it's referring to, because we just simply can't isolate sub D in a vacuum and say, well, any violation of any other state statute that is above a limit of some kind, whether it's impairment-related or absolute sobriety-related or some other violation, that's impairment. And that's the problem that we're having this morning, trying to make sense of what the state's position is going to be here, because in the field, as defense attorneys and prosecutors, we have to make sense of this too. And I always thought that the counting statute under 343.307 dealt with impaired driving offenses, whether it's per se or whether or not it's presumed once you reach a certain level.
Well, D says convictions under the law of another jurisdiction that prohibits a person from refusing chemical testing. That's not.
For an impaired driving offense.
I know, but you don't know whether he's impaired if he refuses the chemical test. I mean, this is an absolute against a conviction for refusing the test.
Yes.
I have a little trouble with that because it seems to overlap E, which doesn't require a conviction, but just says suspension or revocation. So if it's just suspension or revocation under the law but doesn't constitute a conviction, it comes under E.
Okay.
Do you disagree?
I disagree. I think the statute as a whole, 343.307, is referring to impaired driving offenses, whether they were the result of a refusal, where you refused a sobriety-based test for impairment. Because in Illinois, Carter could have been cited for operating under the influence in this particular case, as well as operating in violation of his absolute sobriety. The officer in the field obviously didn't feel that there was evidence of impairment to prosecute concurrently, as we do in our state as well, an OWI along with a violation of a refusal, for instance, or an absolute sobriety violation in addition to an OWI. They're not one in the
same.
Where
is that in the record? I'm just trying to stick to what the record is. Where is that officer's determination in the record?
By the lack of a conviction for a DUI and any evidence being submitted by the state in this particular case that Carter was also convicted of a DUI out of that. Otherwise, we would have seen a DUI-related judgment and conviction in his driving record. So we can infer by the lack of any entry in his driving record that it didn't occur in this case, that it was simply zero tolerance or absolute sobriety-related only.
You could also infer that he simply refused. So you can't cite him for a DUI if you don't know what his alcohol content is, but my understanding of Illinois law was there had to be probable cause for him to think that the driver had ingested some alcohol.
Yes, but there could also be a DUI-related refusal as well, which is a different statutory procedure from an absolute sobriety refusal. Not all refusals are created equal.
If this statute's designed to deal with impaired driving, why would a .02 violation count as a prior? That's basically absolute sobriety. You use mouthwash, you're above a .02.
Correct. And that's not what this statute is referring to. It's referring to convictions in other jurisdictions of impaired driving, and we'll let those other states, since we no longer have to have absolute or strict conformity with Wisconsin, we have to let those other states define what impairment is or under the influence is in their respective states. But Illinois has told it, and I'm afraid we have to get down and dirty in situations like this because we're talking about the imposition of fairly significant criminal penalties in some instances. And we have to get down and dirty and look at the statute that the state is relying on either the conviction or the suspension or the revocation to determine.
In order to do that, counsel, I'd like to come back to the second part of Justice Rogensack's question, which I don't think was addressed. And that went to my questioning of Mr. Sanders in regard to the administrative proceedings, which would require the officer to have had some kind of probable cause showing for impairment. They can't just run around giving these tests. There has to be, according to what Mr. Sanders told us in response to my questioning, evidence at an administrative proceeding that there would have been some probable cause for the detention and the stop and the administration of the sobriety test.
In Illinois, for an absolute sobriety violation or zero tolerance violation, all the officer has to do is swear a report that he pulled the driver over for a violation, and that during the course of that stop, he or she had reason to believe that there was the consumption of some alcohol. If the officer felt there was impairment as well, it would proceed under a different track and perhaps even a concurrent track.
Right.
So that's the distinction that I guess I'm trying to make and why I think we need to look at the section as a whole and understand that I think we're talking about impairment or under the influence. And we now know with the change in the law that that differs from state to state. And we look at Puchas, which I think Mr. Sanders argued. Puchas dealt with a situation where we were dealing with a Michigan statute that made it illegal for someone to operate a motor vehicle while visibly impaired, something that we don't have in this state. Yet in Puchas, this court, or the court, elected to find that that was a violation in Wisconsin because it was a fell within the definition of impaired driving in Michigan statute. So we did look at Michigan statute in that particular case to make sure that that was something that was considered under the influence.
Right, but the two are not disharmonious. If the officer comes to a determination of probable cause that the underage driver had consumed some intoxicating beverage, had some alcohol, then wouldn't that be a violation of Illinois' prohibited alcohol content?
No, because the Supreme Court of Illinois has reviewed the legislative history and has gone into an analysis and has determined that there is no violation in Illinois, unlike Wisconsin.
For the purpose of Illinois.
For the purpose of Illinois.
However, when it comes to this state's review of the pertinent records,
well, it's considered a violation in Wisconsin, a violation of absolute sobriety. We call them absolute sobriety violations. We don't refer to them as statutory summary suspensions like they do in Illinois. So there is a difference. And under this counting statute that the state is relying on, had it not been legislatively exempted from counting, as we did in this particular state with our own absolute sobriety violations, under the broad definition that the state's using, it should have counted in this state. And I don't know what sense it makes to differentiate absolute sobriety violations from our own constituents, from our own state, and make them less serious than absolute sobriety violations coming from another state. It doesn't make sense.
Well, but that goes to some of the questioning of Mr. Sanders earlier, that each of the several states can set their own prohibited alcohol concentration levels, and the analysis would be the same.
Correct.
Do you believe that we apply the definition of conviction out of 340.01 to our interpretation of 343.307?
I guess that's the crux of the issue as I see it, because there is a broad definition of conviction. I would argue in Mr. Carter's case that there is no discretion. If you read the Arvia decision, the Secretary of State's office, upon receiving proof or a sworn affidavit of the officer that stops, that there was a violation and that there was some reason to believe, must, cannot exercise any discretion at all, has to rubber stamp that suspension. And I would argue that that is not a review, so to speak, of an administrative tribunal, because they are duty-bound to support the suspension unless a hearing is requested.
But, Counselor, if I would buy your argument, then no one would ever request a hearing because then it could never be counted out of state. And that same section says it's immaterial whether there was an appeal or not, right? And that's
right.
What 340.01 says.
But we're referring to an actual formal conviction, something other than an administrative review, because in my opinion, there would have been no need for the legislature to add sub D.
Well, why would you, going back to 340.01, which is what I think is critical, and what I see the conflict in the Court of Appeals is one case says, yep, you use it, and the other case says, no, you don't use it. So I want to get your thoughts fully on why you think it applies or does not apply. And they don't just use the word adjudication, they use disposition. You know, if you look at the statute, it's written in a way that was obvious the legislature was wanting to include more in there than simply a regular court proceeding. Unvacated adjudication of guilt or a determination that the person has violated or failed to comply with the law in a court of original jurisdiction, which we're not looking at, or an authorized administrative tribunal. And, you know, if you say, well, if he'd gone on for a hearing and the result was the same, he still got his license yanked, then you would agree that's an administrative adjudication, but the statute says it's immaterial whether an appeal has been taken. So, you know, I'm not sure you can read it quite that way.
Well, I guess I would go back then and speak to the fact that it is not a violation of Illinois law to violate absolute sobriety in Illinois. Therefore, he has not violated or has been found to have failed to comply with the law because there is no violation for absolute sobriety or zero tolerance in Illinois.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I understand your argument better now. Thanks.
So it's our position that even if this court chooses to apply the broad definition under 340.01 sub 9R, that would not, under these facts, meet the criteria. Because under the Arvia decision, which the Supreme Court of Illinois had a chance to review, they went through the statutory distinctions between a DUI and a zero tolerance. And even the Supreme Court of Illinois has determined that it is not a violation or it is not illegal in Illinois for someone under the age of 21 to consume any intoxicants. This is a built-in administrative incentive, if you will, for Illinois drivers to remain absolute sobriety or to maintain absolute sobriety if they're under the age of 21. And I think that's what this statute, this particular statute is. Now, I'll acknowledge that this is not the same in other states. Our surrounding states have taken very different views on minors consuming intoxicants. And in fact, some states, our sister states even, have criminalized operating with a prohibited alcohol concentration in a range of alcohol between 0.2 and 0.8. Michigan, for instance, makes it a misdemeanor for someone under the age of 21 to consume more than 0.02, even if they're not charged with an OWI. And in that statute, it's very clear that Michigan intends to count that as a violation. There is nothing administrative about it. It isn't something that the Secretary of State's office in Michigan has to follow through on. It is a conviction, and there is no issue or dispute about what would happen in that particular instance. And we would, in my mind, have to follow Michigan law because they deem that to be a range of impairment or a range that they will find a violation of the law, which I think would fall under the broad category that's being suggested under 340.01 sub 9R. So what may be true in Illinois in this court may be different in other states based on the way other states have viewed the issue of whether or not minors under the age of 21 should be permitted to operate a motor vehicle with any measurable level of alcohol. And I think on that point, that is something that this court can look at. I think that we need to take and look at the statutory framework that these other violations or these other administrative suspensions or revocations come from in order to make sure that they are considered a violation of that state's laws. And absent a violation of a law, our reading is that the only way the state can use this particular suspension is under sub E.
Is under sub E?
Sub E is an Edward. 343.307 sub 1 sub E.
Suspension for refusal.
Right. And that's what Mocton addressed. Because Mocton distinguished and made a point saying this is a question of statutory construction. There is a more specific definition of revocation or refusal, rather, in sub E than there is in sub D. Otherwise, there would have been no need for the legislature to add sub E and talk about suspensions and revocations. So in this particular case, we're dealing solely, not with a violation of the law, but we're dealing with a license suspension, an administrative license suspension. And there has been no proof or adequate proof presented in my mind that that was for a refusal.
What is in the record? Small, but I haven't looked at it, looked at your appendix. What is in the record that tells us what happened in Illinois? Now, I think it's the state's brief has at pages 128 and 129 what looks like a search of the records, and that they give you what the driver's record is in Illinois.
That is correct.
So it says zero tolerance suspension in 608.99. And it has him speeding. And there's a violation of the seatbelt. Then he disregards the stop yield sign. This is all within 6 months, I think, if I'm reading it right, roughly. He was convicted not less than two offenses. And then we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 offenses. And these are hard to read, but they're all for driving while suspended, right?
Correct.
All right. Do we have anything more than this?
No. That's all we've got.
That's all we got.
That's it.
Could we get it? Could the state have brought in more?
Absolutely. These records are available through the Secretary of State's office. The
state of Illinois.
Of Illinois.
And would it have shown? I'm not asking you to say what showed is in this record, because I assume you got it. Would it have shown what the police report was for?
It would have shown whether or not the suspension was based on a refusal to submit to testing or whether
that would
or
have, the person I assume that's on the basis of the Secretary, what the Secretary of State
right.
said. Okay. And we don't have that in this record.
No.
And that's why I asked the state, do they want another shot at this? And I assume you would object on the grounds they had their chance and didn't do it and case closed.
Yes. And in fact, we attempted to argue.
I'm surprised and shocked at your answer. I'm teasing you. Go ahead.
That the suspension, the original suspension on Mr. Carter's driving record was about a month and 10 days short of what we would have expected a zero tolerance suspension to have been for a refusal.
There's a range. I saw this, but I've now forgotten. What's the range?
It is a minimum of 6 months.
Okay.
For a refusal on a first offense, and then I believe the second offense is 2 years, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. And so how long was he suspended here?
Well, the suspension remained in
effect. You tell.
Uh-huh. For five, the first one was a little over 4 months.
Oh, it's 9/18/99.
5 months, yeah. And it was a month and 10 days short.
Yeah, six, so it's about... Okay, got it.
And there could be other reasons, valid reasons, why the suspension may have appeared longer for the second one that's entirely unrelated to whether or not it's a refusal or not. And that could be whether or not that person paid the reinstatement fee or have followed through with any other of the required assessments that are ordered as a result of certain findings by another court. For instance, if we violate a drunk driving statute and we're convicted, we may not be able to reinstate our license until we satisfy the assessment order and follow through with our driver safety plan. So there could be other reasons unrelated to whether or not it's a refusal or not as to why that suspension may have remained in effect for as long as it did. And that's why I think the Mockding Court was basically correct in its analysis that there are purely administrative proceedings ancillary to an OWI that can affect someone's operating privileges. But in our state, we have statutorily exempted administrative suspensions relating to OWIs from our statutes because there is no finding, underlying finding of guilt in that particular case. And I think that's a fair approach because that person has been put on notice. For instance, in Mockton, the defendant in Mockton could have won the underlying OWI that that person may have been charged with, but lost the administrative suspension, and under the state's analysis, that's going to count. In Illinois, for instance, if Carter had also been charged with a DUI, concurrent with his absolute sobriety violation, he could have won the OWI, but under the state's analysis, his absolute sobriety violation or his zero tolerance violation is still going to come in under sub D.
Under the state's analysis, would both convictions come in? Assuming your hypothetical in Illinois, there was an OWI conviction and absolute sobriety conviction?
No, I think only one would count because they arose out of the same incident. But it's two different ways, two different kicks at the cat, so to speak. And, you know, the legislative backdrop here is, you know, we're trying to get drunk drivers off the road, impaired drivers off the road, not persons that have violated or have been found to be have been statutorily suspended as a result of consuming any alcohol without any evidence of impairment. We are not advancing the legislative purpose of our drunk driving laws by including these other violations or these statutory suspensions into the mix because there's been no proof presented that they were impaired to begin with.
So, counsel, I need to understand your argument. Is your argument that this, in order for a prior to count, there has to be impaired driving involved?
Personally, yes. That's what I'm advancing. That there has to be some evidence of that person being under the influence or meet the statutory definition of impairment in the state from which it arose. Because at that point,
what about the fact that Wisconsin has chosen to allow prior convictions for prohibited alcohol concentration, regardless of impairment, to count as a prior? How does that comport with your reasoning of counting?
Because in that situation, the legislature has made it a per se violation, like we have with many of our drug influence of a restricted controlled substance. We have made that now, pursuant to legislative act, a per se violation if there's any detectable level of certain restricted controlled substances. We're no longer permitted to argue, well, this person wasn't impaired because of it. The legislature has taken that step away and has presumed it. And some of these other states have done the exact same thing.
So then it's not impairment that really holds the day as far as counting priors. It's whether it's a violation of the law.
Relating to impairment. Different states have defined impairment differently.
But people who are 0.02 aren't necessarily impaired, yet that's a potential violation of the law. A juvenile or someone under 21 who has any amount of alcohol and is convicted, you're saying that doesn't count in Wisconsin as a prior?
I'm saying that different states can legislate what impairment is, whether it's real or not, whether you can prove that it was actually impairment. I'd like to think that most people that are stopped and arrested in this state on a fourth offense at a .02 are probably not under the influence, and I think we would all agree with that, but the legislature has said that based on the priors, you are. And other states have done the exact same thing.
So doesn't it send a pretty strong message if another state has an absolute sobriety provision, that that is something that they are saying they don't want people doing that when they're driving on the roads?
Yes.
Even whether they're impaired or not. Just like in Wisconsin,
right.
.02, or, you know, you may have a juvenile who has the ability to hold their alcohol. That doesn't necessarily mean they're impaired while driving, yet it's a violation.
And that is absolutely correct. That's why this same set of facts could have come under and from a different state. And that person, and here's why, and we could have had a different result, I think, in the Court of Appeals. And I think ultimately what we're looking for is notice. That person in that state at the time that they were found to be impaired, whether it was a per se finding of impairment based on their level or range that they were in, that person was put on notice within that state that they were subject to future punishment for impaired driving. Carter received no notice in Illinois. In fact, the statute specifically exempts the alcohol concentration from being used in these subsequent civil or criminal proceedings. It isn't. But so I would imagine the great majority of these suspensions are not contested because the consequences do not flow from that. It can't be used as a prior offense, count as a prior offense in Illinois. And they're already told that it doesn't have any collateral consequences as far as any subsequent criminal proceeding or civil proceeding is concerned. So they haven't been given notice, fair notice in my mind, that it's going to be used against them at a later date, 10, 15, 20 years down the road. And in a situation where someone is cited, even if we don't believe that they're impaired, but that state law says you're impaired, and they're found guilty of a violation because they violated a range or went above an excess of a specified level, they are put on notice within that state, fair notice in my mind, that that could be used against them someday. And that's exactly what Michigan did. Michigan prohibits minors under 21 from 02 to 08. That is a violation. It's not a statutory summary suspension. It's a violation. And at the time the law was initially created, they didn't count that as a prior. But the legislature in Michigan went back in a couple years later and did change it and now counts underage zero tolerance or absolute sobriety violations as priors for enhancing their own penalties. And what Mockton was trying to say is that's the job for the legislature to do in our state. We can't turn this into a new superclass of violations or convictions that didn't exist before. It doesn't work in Illinois. We all agree that the zero tolerance can't be used to enhance in Illinois. And we all agreed that absolute sobriety violations in Wisconsin, which is the same equivalent of what we have, can't be used as priors here. But we rub those two together, and we have this result that, oh, it now does count. And I think that that's unfair, and I don't think that that's what the intent of the legislature was in drafting this statute. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Sanders, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I guess I don't agree that the impairment standard is really what we're dealing with here. It's only a matter of whether the defendant drove with a prohibited alcohol concentration. He did. He was above .00. In this state, we do count .02s. It doesn't mean that the person is impaired. If a different state only had .02s and anything above that would count, we would count that here. So I don't think that that can be the standard. I think in terms of 340.019R, we do have to apply that to 343.307 because of 343.01, which says you do count it unless a different definition is specifically provided. There isn't one. In the Machen case and now Carter, they looked to 340.01, which allowed them to look at the context, but they didn't look at 343.01, the specific statute for that chapter, which says you have to count, or which says that you have to apply all of the definitions in 340.01, which obviously includes 340.01IR. I think looking at whether the other state, how they would treat these, and if they would count them as offenses for subsequent offenses, would lead us down a bad path. If a different state chose to only have first offenses, so that if you had 10 of these, all of them count as first, and you could never have anything more than that, we obviously would count all of them. We wouldn't say, well, they don't count them as prior offenses, so we aren't going to, because under our statute, you obviously do. And if they have some strange statute where they choose not to, that doesn't mean that the Wisconsin law wouldn't count them.
The other option would be to have every time someone's convicted of an OWI, the judge go through the state of the law in every single state so that someone's on notice. And if that law ever changes, then, of course, it wouldn't count, right?
Right, which we can't do. I would want to add something. The ADA who handled this case, who just retired, is the most knowledgeable and aggressive drunk-driving attorney in the state. He goes to great lengths to make sure that he knows exactly what happened in the other state. If it were really easy to get any type of record from the other state that would have indicated whether this was a refusal or a PAC, I don't think he wouldn't have done it. I don't think it's easy. I think it's actually really difficult. It takes a great deal of time to try to figure out what happened. And in this case, it's just so clear that it doesn't really matter what happened. Either way, it counts. It's just a question of whether it counts under D or under E. As to E, I do agree that there is a redundancy there, that there are certain cases which are going to fall under D and E, but I don't think that there's any indication that in passing E, our lawmakers intended to limit what was going to count. It was more adding and to make sure that if there was a suspension or a revocation for a refusal, it's going to count so that there wouldn't be any question.
Counsel, do you happen to know the law in Illinois that if an Illinois minor were in Wisconsin and violated in Beloit the absolute sobriety law, would that count as a prior in Illinois? Do you know that?
I don't know. But for the purposes of our law, I also think it doesn't really matter. Whether they count ours or they don't count theirs or they do count theirs, I don't think makes any difference. They could choose to have a law that is extremely different than ours, and our statute and our cases have made clear that it doesn't really matter. It's a question of what our law says and whether what he did was a violation of their law, and if so, we count it if it falls under our statute. And I think it clearly does.
Respond to your opposing counsel's argument that under the Avena decision, that it is not an Illinois Supreme Court, it's not a violation of law?
I don't think the court said it's not a violation of the law. I think that came from an article that was in the brief. I think I said in the state's reply brief that I don't know that there is a statute that's exactly like our 346.632M, which specifically says it's against the law for a person who's underage to drive with some alcohol. However, it's clear that you can't drink if you're underage, and there is a law, which I did cite. And it's clear that in this case, he lost his operating privilege for something. So I don't think it's really logical to say that he didn't break some law if he had a sanction, which Illinois courts, in a case which I cited again, termed a punishment for having operated with some alcohol in his system in violation of their absolute sobriety law.
We have three cases from the Court of Appeals, all published. The first one is List in 2004. And in that case, the Illinois issue was a court supervision, diversion. Court said that's a conviction under 9R. It says not under an adjudication of guilt, but under the provision of determination that the person has violated or failed to comply with the law, because it wasn't guilt. Okay. In 2007, we have a Court of Appeals decision, and this was an administrative suspension. And the court said 9R doesn't apply and distinguishes List because it doesn't have authority to overrule it.
It said it was distinguishing it. I would argue that it didn't really distinguish it, but it did something so that it didn't go the same way.
Specifically in List, we stated List placement violated 9R. Here, it says the circuit court didn't accept State's argument that it was an out-of-state administrative suspension should also be considered a determination he's violated under 9R. Court noted and the State acknowledged Wisconsin law precludes in-state administrative suspensions from being counted. Therefore, there was a distinction in that. Then, before we took this case, this court met February 2010, and before the court met, or I should say right after, right, no, before, but it may not have been published and we may have missed it, we had State versus Kuchach, right? Mm-hmm. And which do you think Kuchach says?
I didn't hear what you said.
What's the holding in the 2010 case?
I think it follows the same approach as in List, where it says you do look to 340.019R because you have to under 340.301.
And what do they say about any other cases, including the earlier Pashkin case?
I don't recall if it addresses it. I did have that case, actually, but I don't recall if it addresses it.
I don't think it does either.
I don't think it
so
actually.
That's the state of the law in Wisconsin,
yes,
at the moment.
Yes, I think there are essentially two cases here and two cases here, and they don't really mesh.
And there are unpublished cases, too.
Oh yes. Yes,
right.
Pointed out in the petition, there was a Court of Appeals case that went one way. Same judge 3 months later went the opposite way.
That was Esposito.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Which I didn't cite, of course, but which is in the petition. I think that in the Machen case, what kind of got lost there is that what happened really is he got a drunk driving where he was in an accident. He caused an accident. He hurt someone. He lost his license after a hearing with counsel, and then he fled. So he lost his license, and that's what the state wanted to count. He didn't get tried because he left. The point of our statute is to not let people do that so that you can't flee, and that's really what the CMVSA was about, and that's how we got to 340.019R, was to not allow, in that case, truck drivers, say, to get a drunk driving in one state, and then leave, and get a drunk driving in a different state, and leave, and just keep going, and never have them counted, because he was never tried, and never therefore had what you would term a judicial conviction. So to fix that, what the CMVSA said was, let's have a very broad definition, and if you jump bail, if you post bond, if you do any of these things, it's going to count.
Thank you, Mr. Sanders.
Certainly.
And thank you, Mr. Kuhari, for your arguments on a new issue, at least to come to this court, apparently one that the Court of Appeals has handled in a variety of ways at a variety of times. That ends our hearing in 08-AP-3144-CR, State versus Carter. We'll take a few moments recess so that the students who wish to leave may leave, and there will be other students coming into the court in recess.